everybody, and welcome to minute 134 of season 8 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we fubar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Christian Johnson Taylor.
Did I get it right? That's me.
Oh, okay.
You did. Thank you so much for having me. Nice to be here.
Yes. Welcome back to the show. It's been so much fun all week talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I've enjoyed it too.
Yeah. So minute 134 begins with an anonymous soldier getting the sticky bomb ready and ends with Upham entering the room. So we talked a little about, we ended yesterday with one of the guys getting a sticky bomb ready, you know, and how the camera kept panning down to the fuse and panning back up to the guy, and he just runs out and goes to stick it on the treads of the tank, and he's about to do it, and then they change the shot and we see it from a different angle, and then we just see the guy just get blown to bits, which I still remember how shocked I was the first time I saw this.
Yeah, you know, me too.
It's something that it's completely unexpected. You know, they explain to us what a sticky bomb is and how it works and all that stuff, and you just don't expect this. And you really can say expect the unexpected when you're dealing with this type of stuff. That's more or less what it comes down to.
He's lulled you into sleep, in a sense, lulled you into safety, because, you know, in the beginning, like I said, he built up this tension, right? There's this tension, but somehow he made you feel like they're going to be okay. Like, at some point you started to think, okay, that first explosion, that was good. They're winning. Like, you now feel like, okay, they're winning. This is going to go well for them. So you don't expect him, you don't expect a bad thing to happen. And what I, you know, what was really cool is you're like, oh, he has a sticky bomb. Clearly the sticky bomb will work. But what I think happened is I don't think that he was given instruction to go. And he certainly didn't use the sticky bomb the way that it was supposed to be used. I don't think. I think that's what happened.
No, well again, the key here is the fact that they kept showing us right before this, you know, the fuse. So he didn't give himself enough time. That's what it comes down to. And the fuse went off too soon. You know, he sort of took too long to get to where he needed to get to. And you see that he hesitates as he's standing next to the tank. You know, it's not as if he immediately puts it on the treads.
Right. So,
you know, it's an interesting way to do it. And now, if you watch it in slow motion, when they show the second perspective of it, you can clearly see that it's a doll. You know.
Yeah, you can. I've slowed things down in this movie, and you several times, every time you can tell it's a doll that they switch out.
Yeah, completely. Just like Corey explained to us how they do it. And, you know, one of the things that I've talked about throughout this, you know, this segment of the movie dealing with the Battle of Rommel, that we don't know how many Allied troops there really are. And unfortunately, the only way for us to count them, because most of them are nameless, is by the number of deaths. So this is actually the first death of one of the Allied soldiers. You know, so right now we have one.
One.
we'll see where that number goes to. Because again, we have no idea how many men are defending Rommel. And then,
but it doesn't seem like a lot. I mean, it doesn't seem like a.
No,
not like 13.
Something like that. I think that's it. Again, I know the answer because I know how many will die over the next over the next 30-35 minutes of the movie, but you know, I won't give it away. I won't give it away at this point. But I had always suspected that there were more than the numbers that we see. And you know, so this guy just unfortunately didn't have much luck. And at this point, Miller realizes that they sort of made a little bit of a mistake at that point, and he turns to the guy next to him and screams to him and goes, "Do it now! Light it up! You light it!" And he points to one of the other guys, you know, that start getting those fuses running, and now we're gonna have to take care of getting getting rid of this tank. And then the shot goes up to the clock tower. And, you know, we see Parker and Jackson up there. Jackson is still giving hand signals of what he sees.
Right.
And Miller sees that and translates it to everyone and says, 30 infantry on the right flank. And, you know, he's aware of the fact that, you know, that it's great that he has this bird's eye view, who's telling him, and this way he can relate to others what's really going on. Now, what I find really strange here is you see these two guys up in the clock tower. Neither of them is wearing a helmet, which well, is probably just to help us identify them. Because you'd think that in a real combat situation, these guys would have helmets on.
You would think, but a lot of times they lose their stuff. Like, I've talked to these guys. They lose their stuff all the time.
That's right.
It's possible that they didn't have them, but it's also possible that it's movie magic.
Right.
They do want you to see their faces. You know, what I didn't understand about this is, Why weren't they giving hand signals all the time? Why weren't they giving more information all the time? Like, they're up there and they can see everything. Why weren't they giving them more information down there?
Well, this isn't the first time they were getting information, you know.
Now, I know, but I mean, it seems like they would have been giving them even more information the whole time. Maybe they were, and we just didn't see that. But
yeah, maybe there wasn't really anything. What are they going to tell them?
No, you know, that's true.
You know, once you say that there's this many tanks and this many that, though, it's not like the numbers are going to change. It's not like
I don't know. Be like, they're coming. They're coming. Like,
that's right.
The redcoats are coming.
I think they, you know, can hear that they're getting closer.
Yeah.
You know, or just see all the gravel moving around them, stuff like that.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I don't know. And then Miller is starting to get everyone ready, you know, to continue to get over this. And, you know, he then gives over the information to them about the fact that, you know, the number of infantry that Jackson has given them. And then the shot changes and we get Mellish and Henderson who are shooting. And, you know, we hear him scream, get over there, find a hole and stop them.
Yeah.
And at this point they say, okay, displace. You know, they realize that they need to now move to another location. And again, it's such a great shot that what they do here, because they show us the turret of the tank turn towards them, and they just get up and get out of there as quickly as possible with this whole thing. And, you know, they just run away, and you see that the tank takes out the exact position of where they were.
Yeah.
And, What's very, very cool here, though, is besides the fact that you see the two of them running in the background of the shot, in the foreground, right at the bottom of the corner of the beginning of the shot, we see Upham, who's just crouching there, trying to hide and hiding his face, you know, with his hands.
I don't think I paid attention to that.
Yeah. And then a plume of dust and smoke, you know, basically covers Upham, who's there, who ends up getting up and then running across the quad after them to try and, you know, get to some sort of safety. And his helmet falls off as he's running. And then Mellish and Henderson climb up the stairs, and he goes up with them. You know, to this notorious room that we're going to see over the next few weeks of where they are. And, you know, Upham is, you know, gets into the room with them. And that's where this minute ends. You know, it's a very action-packed minute. There's a lot going on.
Very tense.
Yeah.
Lots of action.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff happens.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And we're trying to figure out what's going on, what they're going to do, all that stuff. And it's great the way that they do this. And also, you know, the realism of it, of the fact that you have to constantly displace and you have to move to different positions, and that they set these up beforehand. They knew where they need to go. You know, we're going to start off by shooting from point A, and our next destination is point B, and then possibly C, and then D. Who knows how many different places they have already set up for where they're going to be shooting when they need to.
Yeah.
And
This is the minute where the movie or the action begins. Like, I mean, it really starts to move here. And you know, we've seen the preparation, we've seen the waiting, and now we're getting into the action of it all.
right. And it's sort of like building up a little bit with the way that they do that. And I like it. I really like the way that they do this. So
Yeah,
it's
it's great.
very cool. Okay, did you have anything else you wanted to talk about with this particular minute?
Not me, no. What about you?
No, nothing else for this minute. But I actually
Great.
wanted to ask you a question. I've been meaning to ask
Sure.
you this question ever since we first met. So what, you know, what just tell us a little about your history with you know, being a filmmaker. Like also, where's your interest? Where did your interest start with World War II, and Normandy, and you know, I mean, I because you and I have talked, I know, you know, that how I know actually how you first got to Normandy, but I'm just saying in general, you know, what led you on the path to seek out doing movies that are related to World War II and everything happening in Normandy. I mean, again, I also know that you're currently working on another movie about Carrington. So, you know,
Yeah.
obviously this is something that's part of your lifeblood with the whole thing. So,
Well, it is now. I mean,
well,
I don't know.
usually a person chooses a path to get somewhere. You know, they knew that they were going in that direction with that type of thing.
I had no idea. I feel like this path chose me. And it's interesting. I feel like this path chose me from a young age. And I say that, I mean, I say that, but I also feel like maybe that God created me for this path, you know, or I don't know. I don't know what to say other than I feel like I have been prepared for this moment in my life since I was a child. And I say that because when I was a young girl, my father used to take me around campaigning in my hometown for Senator Trent Lott. And at that time, he was nothing and he wanted to be a congressman. And so my dad would take me around. And I remember going into the projects and one of the men or one of the doors opening, and it was a man in a wheelchair with a missing leg. And I asked my dad, you know, Daddy, what happened to his leg? And he said, young lady, that man gave his leg for your freedom.
Wow.
And you need to thank him. He's a veteran. Every time, you know, you see a veteran, you need to tell him thank you for your freedom. So that was my introduction to what veterans do so that I could be free. Now he would always tell me, you're able to vote, you're able to be free. All the things that I had, he would say, were because of these men. Back then it was men, you know. So I understood the cost of my freedom from a young age. And then my father was also involved in politics, and so we were a very patriotic family. And I, you know, then went to a very good boarding school in Long Island, New York, and I had a wonderful teacher named Milton Hostetter, and he was a fantastic American history teacher. And World War II just happened to be my favorite subject. I do not know why. I can't explain it, but all of that history sort of stuck in my head. And the music, I loved the Andrews Sisters, just the Glenn Miller, all of the 40s stuff stuck in my head. Don't know why. And then, interestingly enough, this is a great fact. I took French and I was terrible at it. I still remembered several things, however, like, you know, I don't know, bonjour and au revoir and comment ça va, and, you know, just a few words and phrases. But what I really remembered was Notre Père qui est aux cieux, ton nom soit sanctifié, ton règne vienne, ta volonté soit faite sur la terre comme au ciel, donne-nous aujourd'hui, and it goes on and on. And it's the Lord's Prayer.
Oh, wow.
Now, why? Why would I remember that and remember nothing else in French? Because I failed French. And I took French twice. I took French in seventh grade. And then I came to my high school, this boarding school in Long Island, New York, and I tried to take it again and failed. And so they put me in Spanish. Anyway, I failed French twice, and all I can remember mostly is the Lord's Prayer. Well, fast forward to 2015, and my son Hunter, who is just gotten back from Afghanistan, and he was supposed to be in a Soldier of the Year competition. He had been winning and winning, and they thought he was going to, he was like the favored to win the division at the 101st Airborne Division. But his leadership did not send him to combatives course, and all of a sudden they changed the regulations and he had to have it. Because he didn't, he was disqualified, very angry and upset about that. His leadership felt terrible. So his consolation prize was a trip to Normandy.
Oh, wow.
So when he told me he was going, I was like, well, I'm going to go see what you're doing. So I followed him. And that is when I discovered that the Normans have been thanking their liberators for the past, at that time, it was 71 years. And I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I couldn't believe that they had been doing that since 1945. And they extend invitations to the units that liberated them, the 82nd, the 101st, the 173rd, the 79th, the 29th. I mean, it goes on and on. They, and not just American, but also Canadian and British. And they ask them to come over and they give them, 10 days or 2 weeks of just a wonderful party and celebration. And they invite the veterans over as well. They also raise money to bring the veterans over and they put them up in their homes and they celebrate them. It just blew my mind. And as I talked to the French people and I saw how they just loved on our veterans, I saw our veterans come to life. And it was like the fountain of youth. I saw our veterans come, in one way and leave with a total like light in their life. I heard one veteran say, when we are here, we are treated as heroes, but back home, they treat us like old men. And I find that to be true. And so I began just kind of, I was so convicted because I thought I was thankful for my freedom until I went to Normandy. And I saw what the Normans feel about their freedom after being liberated. And so I felt like that as we as Americans needed to understand what freedom looked like through French eyes, and that I needed to tell the story. And I'm an actress by trade, I'm a voiceover actor. And so I went to a lot of my producer friends and asked them to make this movie. And they're like, yeah, that's a great idea. You should make the movie. And I was like, well, how hard can that be? I mean, it can't be that hard. I mean, I've been in movies, it can't be that difficult. And truly, ignorance, is bliss. I really had no idea. I learned how to make a movie by watching Ken Burns of a masterclass. And I watched the first introduction, and just watching the introduction alone, like I was blown away and I was in tears by the end because everything that he said was really everything that I needed to know, which was it is going to be hard being a producer or a filmmaker. You're going to have to solve a million problems. That's what it's all about. You're never going to have enough money. You just need to do it and just never quit. And it was so inspiring. And then I learned some nuts and bolts, but the bottom line was I just had to jump in and do the thing. And I didn't know that it would normally take, 5 or 10 years to do a documentary. So, I was like, I started thinking that I would do this documentary and started researching it, 2016, 2017. But I started in earnest, raising money and making it in January of 2018. And I told the French people and everybody that I wanted to have it done and show it on Utah Beach in 2019. So I was like, it'll take a year and a half. I'll show it, for the 75th anniversary of D-Day. And I had some horrific circumstances, including the original partners completely turning on me and trying to blow up the entire project while we were shooting and sabotaging it once we got back and not helping me at all with it. Including completely running out of money. The list goes on and on and on. And only by a miracle of God was I able to have a film that I screened on Utah Beach for the 75th anniversary of D-Day.
Oh, wow. That is just amazing.
Yeah, it was it was the rough cut, so it was 2 hours long at that time. It's now an hour and 29 minutes, but in a much better story. So it wasn't completely ready, but I was amazed that I had anything at all. And it was only done by, you know, a collaborative effort with a bunch of really amazing people that did stand by me, and a lot of people that donated time and energy, and because they believed in what we were doing. And that's my story.
Wow. That is just so amazing. And again, what you want to talk a little bit about the project you're working on now, or you don't want to give away too much
sure.
information?
No, 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 no. Yeah. So the project I'm working on right now is called Heroes of Carentan. It's you can find more about it on heroesofcarentan.com. So after the success of The Girl Who Wore Freedom, which has been wildly successful, it's on Amazon, Apple TV, Vudu, blah, blah, blah. And it's also been on Delta and United, and we're working to get it on other airlines. It's on Canal Plus in France. And so in any French speaking country, you can watch it on Canal Plus. And we're hoping to get other international releases. But Heroes of Carentan, the town came to me and asked me to tell the story. And I thought, wow, absolutely. And I have two kids in the 101st Airborne Division and a lot of connections there. And so I should be able to do it. So the only thing that, so the purpose that behind it is I wanted to highlight Carentan, because nobody really knows about it. They know the third episode may be a Band of Brothers, but that was 25 years ago.
Right.
So, and most people don't know that anymore. So they don't really know about the town of Carentan. And if you ask most people in the world what the 101st Airborne is, they don't know. They don't know.
Well, they're wrong.
I'm sorry.
They're wrong.
I know, but most people don't know. Most people don't know. I've been out there doing man on the street interviews and they don't know. And so I just thought, you know, nobody's going to know Robert Cole or John Stopka or any of these guys that helped to liberate this town. And these men were unbelievably amazing. And so their heroism and their courage and their, you know, all of the skills that they had, the echoes of their valor have translated all the way down to the modern day soldiers today. And I really wanted to make this film accessible and interesting to our younger generations. And I thought, how can I do that? So I did have access to the 101st Airborne Division today. And so I asked the Department of Defense if they would approve my project, which they did. And they gave me access to ask, our modern day soldiers to interview them. So these soldiers that I interviewed were just coming back from the border of Ukraine, the first deployment. And I talked to them about how the soldiers in 44 impacted them. And so they talked to me about their heroes from 1944 and why they made a difference. So, for example, I interviewed General J.P. McGee, who is the general of the 101st Airborne Division, about General Max Taylor, who was the general of the 101st Airborne Division in 1944.
Wow.
And so he talked about that general. And so, you know, the person in Robert Cole's position now, I asked him and he talked about Robert Cole. And person in John Stopka's position talked about John Stopka. So I matched it up that way. And so my hope is that, you know, we'll be able to listen to, you know, I wanted modern day soldiers to talk about what it was like to be deployed away from your family. What's it like to lose your friends? What's it like to be in combat? So what did these guys in 44, what they went through, you know, you've read their stories, you've listened to what they did. You know, what have you learned from them? What can we learn from them today? And then what can we learn from these soldiers today? So that's what I hope my film can do. Now, we're in post-production. We've shot half of it, and I still need to raise my finishing funds. And I've asked Donnie Wahlberg to narrate it, so that we're still hoping that will happen. That would be amazing. So there's that. And the other thing is I'm working on a 10-part series called The Brave Dutch. which is a story of, about a friend of our family's who was shot down over Apeldoorn in Holland in February of 1944, kept alive by the Dutch resistance, and was able to get back to Allied lines by, I think it was November of 45. No, that's not true. May of 45. It was before the war ended, I think. I have to figure it out. It's been so long, I can't believe I can't remember.
Wait a second. I saw a movie recently that basically tells that a similar type of story.
Travel by Dark, by any chance, by Graham Moore.
Who's the main actor?
Well, I don't know who the main actor is.
It was Bill Paxton. That's who it was. There was a movie with Bill Paxton. It was a movie called Resistance from 2003, where he played Major Theodore Ted Bryce.
I'm going to write that down. I haven't seen that.
On January 16th, 1944, a reconnaissance pilot survives a plane crash in Delahot in the Nazi-occupied Belgium. It's Belgium. The idea of him getting connected to the underground in order to try and get out of there.
Yeah, this is fascinating. This is
again, I don't know if this story that, you know, with the movie Resistance, I don't know if it's a true story or not.
Well, my story is a true story.
No, that I know.
It's based on John Lau's life. John Lau is from my hometown of Laurel, Mississippi. And he, when he got back to Allied lines, they put him in Paris, questioned him. And then he wrote an homage to all of the people that helped him be free. And he named them and he told what he did and he wrote it down in this document. He kept in touch with them through the 70s. They wrote letters back and forth. His grandson did a podcast. It is called The Brave Dutch. You can look it up and listen to it. He's basically just reading the document that his grandfather wrote. And I'm collaborating with the family. They're close friends of mine in order to do this 10-part series, but it's just still in development and I'm trying to raise money in order to do the series as well. So haven't gotten a lot of, you know, hadn't gotten very far with that one, but it's an incredible story. I'm very passionate about it.
Wow. That's great. Very cool.
Yeah.
So every Thursday we have a segment called Say What Thursday. Where the idea here is it's a game. There are a lot of known and unknown actors in this movie at the time of when it came out. So the game is very simple. I will give you a movie quote and I will tell you what year it came out, and you will have to tell me who the actor from Saving Private Ryan is who said this particular line and in what movie. Now, obviously,
I'm gonna fail.
Obviously, because I'm gonna there fail. Are so many choices here. So I've narrowed it down to three.
Okay. Is it multiple choice?
Well, it's multiple choice with the three. So it's either going to be Tom Hanks, Paul Giamatti, or Corey Johnson.
Oh, okay good. Okay, that's good. There's hope for me now.
Yeah, those are the three choices. Again, okay. I will tell you the year, and I will tell you the quote.
Okay.
So we'll start with the first one from 1994, and the quote was, "We was always taking long walks, and we was always looking for a guy named Charlie."
Tom Hanks.
In what movie?
Don't know.
1994. We talked about it earlier this week. We talked about it with Corey.
Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump. There you go. Excellent. Okay.
That was what I thought at first, but didn't want to sound stupid. So I sounded stupid anyway. I should have just said.
You sounded stupid because you didn't say it. No, I'm just kidding.
I know.
No, come on. This game is all for fun. That's it. No one, you know.
All right.
Okay. All right. Here's the next one from 2006. I got it. It's a fake. Okay. Remember, it could be Tom Hanks. It could be Paul Giamatti, or it could be Corey Johnson.
I have no idea. Don't know that one.
Okay, we talked about this movie earlier this week also, from 2006.
We talked about so many, I'm lost. I don't know. Okay, Corey Johnson.
And in what movie was Corey in 2006 that we talked about earlier this week?
United 93.
Exactly. Perfect. The next one is from 2013, and the quote is, "A man cannot break a promise he's made to his kids, no matter how long it takes him to make it come true."
Okay, that's Tom Hanks.
Okay.
And that is, oh man, that is, oh gosh. Is it Castaway or?
No, Castaway is 2000. And this is 2013.
Oh, shoot. It's in my brain. I mean, I know this. A man can't break a promise to his kids.
No matter how long it takes for him to make it come true. I mean, you get the Tom Hanks part, so now you just have to guess what movie it is.
I know the movie. I know the movie. I'm going to kill myself because I know the movie. Give me another hint.
Okay, it is Emma Thompson is also in this movie.
I don't, that's not going to help me. Come on, what is it? Oh, just tell me.
It's Saving Mr. Banks.
Oh, that's it. That's it. I thought you said Anna Thompson. If you would have said Emma Thompson, I would have gotten it. I love that movie. I should have put that on my list. I didn't put that on the list of Tom Hanks movies. I love that movie. All right, next.
Next one is from 2011. Okay,
Okay.
if things were easy to find, they wouldn't be worth finding.
Paul Giamatti.
Nope.
I don't know. Corey Johnson.
Nope.
Tom Hanks.
Very good.
Sleepless in Seattle.
2011, not 1993.
Oh yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Catch me if you can.
That was 2002.
Gosh, I can't believe you know when these movies came out. I don't know. I don't know when any of these movies came out. I don't know dates. I don't know names. I don't know anything. I barely remember the movies. Come on now.
Okay, this one's extremely loud and incredibly close, which is,
That's the name of the movie?
yeah, it's a movie about 9/11.
Okay, I would have never known that.
Okay, all right,
Never.
and the
All right.
final one for you, okay, are you from 2013 also? Are you all right, Mrs.? Would you like me to drive you home?
Saving Mr. Banks.
And who's the character?
Paul Giamatti.
Excellent.
I love that movie. Okay, yay, I ended on a good note.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, would you like to once again tell people where they can find you?
Yes, you can find me at documentaryfirst.com or thegirlywarfreedom.com where you can find my film, or you can find me on any of the social media channels at Documentary First, or just email me at christian@documentaryfirst.com.
All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Instagram, find me on Twitter, find me on Facebook. You can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movieroundminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn this.
In my solitude, you reveries of days gone by.